Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This ain't Texas.
This is Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, is full of country songs like Texas Hold'em. That's the song that you're hearing right now. The song hit number one on Billboard's Hot Country Songs within 10 days of its February release. But Beyonce isn't just topping the charts with the new album. Cowboy Carter is bringing attention to the role that Black artists have always played in country music. It's a lineage that includes some of the most influential country classics, like Blue Yodel No. 9. The song was recorded by Jimmy Rogers, but you can hear Louis Armstrong on the trumpet and Lil Hardin on piano. There's also a more recent history of Black country music. It includes songwriter Alice Randall. Alice Randall co-wrote the song X's and O's, An American Girl. It was first recorded by Trisha Yearwood. That song spent 2 weeks at number one on Billboard's Hot Country Songs. Randall is also a best-selling novelist and professor of African American and Diaspora Studies and writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Her newest book is a memoir. It's called My Black Country, a journey through country music's Black past, present, and future. Alice Randall, it is such an honor to have you on Disrupted.
I am thrilled to be on Disrupted. I love the title of your show, and I'm intrigued by you and your journalism. So I'm just delighted to be here.
Thank you. I want to talk to you for so many reasons. We love on this show featuring people who are disruptors in the best of ways. And we are hearing so much chatter right now about artists like Beyonce and Lil Nas X and the ways that they are exploring their musical talents in genres that many people may or may not have expected. So I want to start by asking you this very basic question, and that is, what is country music and how did you discover your love for it?
Well, country music is a genre, and genre, I think of it in terms of likeliness test, not litmus test. But for me, country music is recorded American music that has these three qualities: Celtic, English, Irish, Scottish ballad forms, plus African-American influences and aesthetics, plus evangelical Christianity. When you get those three things together, you are likely to be in the presence of a country song. I also think that it's important to think about themes. Country is a very lyric-driven form. And the four basic themes of country, as I understand them, are life is hard, God is real, the road, liquor, and family are significant compensations, and the past is better than the present. When you get those four themes present, you are likely to be engaged with the country song.
I have to ask you, because as you were just laying that out, I thought all of the songs I loved growing up from Loretta Lynn and Charlie Pride captured all of those elements in the most beautiful ways that were relatable, regardless of where one lived or what one went through. But you are someone who grew up in Detroit just as Motown was starting to take off. What is it about country music and those elements that made you say, I connect to this and this is what moves me?
One, as you say, I was born in Detroit in 1959. I was born in the very same year as Motown Records. But that first part, life is hard, God is real, that was part of my Black girlhood in Detroit, evangelical Christianity. But also, personally, I had a crazy mother, a not very good mother. But my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt had only one thing in common. And that was all three of them loved, and they were all Black women, country music. They loved different forms of country music, But it's the one thing they loved in common. So I think I was just destined to love it too. But because I had that crazy mother, I had a lot of experience from childhood with life being hard. And so from my very early days, when I was 3, 4 years old, I was making up little songs that were effectively country songs.
You have a new book. It's called My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. I have to tell you, I am so excited and blessed that I have a copy of that book in my hands. What has it been like for you to create this memoir and bring to the public many of these things that most people like to put in a closet, but you're saying, I am giving this to the world? What's that journey been like for you?
No, it has not been easy. It reminds me of that Langston Hughes song, a poem I love so much, Mother to Son, Life for Me Ain't Been No Crystal Stair. But what I love is at 64, about to be 65 years old, is that my journey, I've lived long enough to be, that it is a trauma to transcendence journey. My last novel, Black Bottom Saints, I felt that the main theme of it is joy is radical, and that is a theme of my life. So I love, actually, from the position of being 64, almost 65, to be able to be witness that art can transform that which is too hard to bear into something that makes the hard bearable. And my life as a country songwriter has been a continuing process of transforming something that was too hard to bear into a song that made the hard bearable for me and for others. And so I rooted in the radical joy. And when you sit with the creation that is beautiful and connects, so it is loving and is generative because it supports other people, that thing that started off as just bitter is no longer that only.
That phrase, from trauma to transcendence, is poignant, but it is one that I think so many people, particularly women, can connect to, that regardless of where one grows up or how one grows up, there is this core and this root that binds us together. And as you said, the power of art, and in particular country music, to be that place for reflection, but also connection, especially when women are discouraged from using their voices. You not only have this connection to country music as a way of working from trauma to transcendence, you are a standout songwriter in a genre where Black women in particular are often not recognized.
And are excluded. Black women are often excluded from the genre. I have coined, I think, a phrase, it may have been used by someone else, I had not heard it, cultural redlining. We are culturally redlined out of country music, just in the same way that real estate redlining worked by not providing enough economic support, not giving bank loans. Black women and women trying to go into country are not given, do not have access to the support systems, to the funding that would allow most of us to succeed. Fortunately, I was able to evade the economic redlining and get resources and find allies. And as a result, I've had songs recorded in the 80s, 90s, zeros, 10s, and 20s. But there was a lot of resistance to that. And I had to use some of my creativity in the space just to find a space for myself.
I appreciate you for naming that, because I think so often when Black women are absent from spaces, people assume that it's something about them or about their talent and their ability. And what you've just named is no, it is structural, it is intentional, in some ways it is generational and enduring. How do you carry that weight of knowing you are in a space that was never intended for you, but you are not only creating and thriving, you're creating pathways for other people? How do you bear witness and bear the weight of that?
The only way to do it is to stay present in your most authentic self and to revive yourself with joy. But one of the most poignant parts of my Black country for me is the story of my grandmother at the funeral or going to the burial of one of her children. She had two sons die early. And as I say in the memoir, I'm not even sure which of the sons the story was about, because when by the time she was telling me, the death of one became the death of the other, and the grief was so extraordinary. But she was literally driving to the burial from the funeral, and the hearse was in front of her with the coffin. And her car, the car she was in, was right behind, was following the hearse. And the back door of the hearse opened, and the coffin fell out onto the road with her dead son's body in it. And I believe it may have split open, but it certainly fell out into the road. And the car she was in touches the coffin. And when my grandmother told that story to me, she told it to me as her son jumping out of the hearse to sing and sign love to her one last time. She told it to me as a love story, that she knew her child knew that she loved them so much that they would jump out of their coffin to love back at her, to reflect love back at her. And what I got from that was, you are not the things in the middle of, I don't know if we can say this on here, but I'm going to say it, the storm in the middle of whatever is happening around you or on you. That's not you. She knew the only, this event was for a moment catastrophic to her. This death was catastrophic. The first son died in a house fire, as my family told it, because the fire department did not come to the Black homes as quickly as they should have. And the second son died because he was being, Black businesses were being unjustly targeted for a kind of scrutiny. And this young man had never had the benefit of a literal education, could barely be read and write and keep the kind of records that he needed, but was having a successful business. And then this business is being persecuted. He's developing an alcoholism, and then he's being not treated well in the hospital. And she felt that he died because of a series of layers of mistreatment. But she let both of their lives not be about the fire department, the racist fire department, not about the unjust persecution of a business. She made their lives about their mother's audacious love of them and their audacious security in that love. I took a lot from that.
Coming up, the story of how Alice Randall wrote X's and O's, An American Girl. Her daughter, Caroline Randall Williams, recorded a reimagining of that song, and it appears on the new album, My Black Country, The Songs of Alice Randall. You're listening to it now. This is Disrupted. Stay with us.
What an American girl is. What an American girl. Used to be hair tied up, wearing ribbons and pearls. But look how she moves now. She's so sweet. She's so tough.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. Hartford Healthcare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers. So we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford Healthcare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. Today, we're talking with country songwriter Alice Randall about her career and her new memoir, My Black Country, a journey through country music's Black past, present, and future. Early in her career, Alice was mentored by famed musician Steve Earle. I asked Alice how she met him.
I met him in 1983, the second night I was in Nashville. He was performing with a little rockabilly trio at a place called the Bluebird that became sort of a songwriter school for me of types. And after I met him, I was working on a song called Dangerous Curves with a wonderful woman, Diana Reed Haig. And I thought, I got to get the song to Steve Earle, talked his number out of another friend and called up Steve. And Steve did not think it made any sense whatsoever that I was calling him. And he called me, as we might say, everything but a child of God. But he also complained that his car had broken down that day and he had to be in the studio. So I said, do you need a ride? And so I picked him up and drove him to the studio and I pressed a cassette in his hand. And he, whatever he hadn't said to me then, he cussed me then. But that on that cassette was my phone number. And not long after, Steve called me and said, you're going to be a hit songwriter one day, and I'm going to help you.
There is a fierceness and a fearlessness as you share these pieces of your journey of believing in yourself, even when it seemed hard or seemed impossible, that you didn't take no. And that even when you heard no, you thought, I can find a different way of doing that.
Well, I love that you say find a different way, because one of my favorite sayings about Black women or about women I respect and love is we are find a way or make a way women. That often you can't find a way, particularly when there's been no path to get from where you are to the place you want to be. When it has never been done for someone like you to get to this place you want to be. You have to make a path. You have to make a way. And when I make a way, one thing I do try to do is make a way that other people can walk down. I do want to blaze paths that other people can walk on and then transform and take branches off of, because I think I'm very excited to be supporting other people in their very original journeys. But the same way I feel that Lil Hardin, who I consider to be the mother of Black country, partially made a way for me by doing things that, and leaving little breadcrumbs I could follow, I want to, at the very least, leave breadcrumbs other people can follow.
Let's talk about some of the breadcrumbs. And I don't think they're breadcrumbs. It feels like they're entire loaves that you are leading to create a path for people. You have created your own music publishing companies. And I think that's critical. Midsummer Music and Mother Dixie Music. So critical to talk about the why behind doing that. Why was it important for you to have your own publishing company?
You know, I founded Midsummer Music when I was about 23 years old. It still exists. I'm very proud of that. It's gone through many permutations. First of all, just looking back for a moment, it was important for me to do that because I knew that publishing was the real estate of the music business. And the reason I knew that was because I was born in Detroit. And I knew, for example, that Motown Records had a publishing arm and that I lived in a community and in a family, particularly my father, that didn't talk about, oh, Alice, go be a singer. It was Alice, be a publisher. Alice, form Motown Records. Alice, create something, an institution where you can employ other people and nurture creatives and push your vision forward. So not just perform. And I'm not limiting. I think performance is wonderful. But and Anna Gordy was a friend of my father's and a person, a hero, a shero that my father put in front of me from earliest days. And Anna Gordy had a publishing company and was a songwriter. I knew she had formed with one of her sisters, Anna Records, before Barry formed Motown Records. So part of that was walking in that woman's path and wanting to create longevity for myself. I wanted to work for myself. I wanted to make money so I could do art that I didn't have to concern myself about in the business place, meaning I wanted to write novels. I knew down the road that I wanted to write just the novel I wanted, not the novel that would make money. So to do that, I had to find something I could make money doing. And I thought that music publishing would be one of those things. I also very much wanted to be involved with songs because my grandfather couldn't read or write at all. And my grandmother had very limited reading and writing. She had never attended a day of school. She was born in the 19th century, the end of the 19th century in Alabama when Black kids were not getting access to school. So songs are text that reach everybody. And my grandmother had so many song and sung text in her head. She also had a lot of the Bible. So she did have actually a large vocabulary from the Bible and sermons that she had heard. So songs to me, I was politically and emotionally connected to them because I also think of songwriting as the elemental art form, because often after giving birth, mothers around the world will sing to their infants. And so I think of it as an elementally feminine art form, but I also realize it's business possibilities that if I publish songs and songwriters, I would have more of my own freedom. I would be owning my own songs completely. I would not. And there's so much exploitation of Black songwriters, Black women in the music business. And I did not evade all of it. But my initial instinct to form my own publishing company was to have more profound control of my own destiny as a songwriter and to be able to create a kind of wealth engine that would give me a kind of freedom if possible.
I want to talk about one of those songs that you created. The song you co-wrote is called X's and O's. It became a number one hit on the country charts. How did that song come about?
Well, I'm so thrilled to say X's and O's was 2 weeks at number one.
Yes.
And it'll be 30 years old this summer. And it is an absolute established country classic that it is now. You can still hear it on the radio throughout the United States. It's one of these songs that has just stayed with us. That song came absolutely from real life and some good luck and bad luck. I was writing a screenplay. I'd written a screenplay and was co-producing a CBS movie of the week. And I had the opportunity to write the theme song because it was a backdoor pilot for a TV series about ex-wives of country stars. So I sat with one of my favorite writers, Matresa Berg, and we wrote a couple of different times and we never got anything good. And so I was having to tell my publisher at the time, I had left from Midsummer, it still existed, but I was working with a bigger publisher and I'm not getting the theme song, it's not happening. They were not happy with me. I have to tell my co-writer, I don't think we got it. She agreed with me. And the next morning I'm depressed with myself about losing this opportunity. And I've taken my child to school. I get a call from the school that I have dropped her off, but I have forgotten to put something that she absolutely had to have in her backpack. And so I'm feeling like 100% failure when I get into the shower. I'm thinking, you got a picture of your mama in heels and pearls and you trying to make it in your daddy's world. And it ain't working, kid. It ain't working. And I said that again. I thought, that's my song. You got a picture of your mama in heels and pearls. You're trying to make it in your daddy's world. And I literally raced after taking what my daughter needed to school, who was just in kindergarten, first grade then. I raced over to Matresa's house, banged on the door. And almost as soon, quickly as that first verse had come to me, phone rings, baby cries, TV diet, guru lies. Good morning, honey. Because that had been my morning. The second verse comes to her. She had a new old house that she was renovating, a new marriage with a wonderful man. And she was thinking, mama needs romance and a live-in maid. She was thinking about the renovations of houses and marriages. And I was thinking about taking care of this kid as a single mama. And we wrote something that a lot of women all across the country could identify with, a song about keeping up the balance between love and money. And it all got done in about 40 minutes or an hour and a half. Sometimes they just come to you. It's all those years of living and all the practice rhyming. And it just comes out because it was like from your veins. It was just the truth of that morning. It was the truth.
Coming up, more from Alice Randall. She'll talk to us about the long history of Black country music. This is Disrupted. We'll be right back.
Love in his heart and flowers in his head. Johnny proposed to Sally, yeah. Sally shivered as she said, I'll love you till the day I'm dead.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Many factors impact a child's achievement. To start, they need the basics like access to healthy food and quality health care. Join me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, as Connecticut Public and the Connecticut Black and Brown Student Union host a one-hour conversation about the importance of safe housing. Wednesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Guard Arts Center in New London. Register at ctpublic.org/safehousing.
Welcome back to Disrupted. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean. This hour, we're talking with Alice Randall, country songwriter and author of the new memoir, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. In the book, Alice says many of the old recordings of her songs were whitewashed. I asked her to explain that.
Well, as I said, I've had songs recorded in the 80s, 90s, aughts, tens, and 20s, but particularly those, and by some very important country songwriters, Glen Campbell, Tricia Yearwood, Mo Bandy, Marie Osmond when she was doing country, but Radney Foster, some great artists. But when they sang, when Radney Foster sang about he rode with the best, hell he rode with me. Or Justin McBride, who was a PBR champion bull rider, actually recorded that song later and had has millions of streams or lots of streams. You have to look up there, lots and lots of streams, lots of streams. When he says that, people don't believe it. They don't believe that if that was a black cowboy, he's as good as Justin McBride. When Radney sings it, some people don't even think the cowboy is black. In fact, because of who's singing it, when they hear he's black as the sky on a moonless night, I have met people that telling me that my song means the man was depressed or wearing black clothes or something else, anything, but he was actually a black man. When Adia Victoria sings it. In this black gothic country way. He rode with the best, he rode with me. It's one great black cowboy celebrating another black cowboy. It opens up this discussion that is actually documented that 20 to 30% of cowboys were black and brown in the American West. But this has gotten erased from our songs and from our films, and it's gotten forgotten from many of our memories, and it's no longer a part of most people's imagination. One of the reasons I love country that we haven't spoken about is that embedded in country, when I say that it's Celtic storytelling plus African influences plus evangelical Christianity, one of the things of the African influences, obviously the banjo is a big one. Some of the styles of singing is another. But one of them, Africa is a large continent with many religions, particularly in the 19th century, in the 20th century, early 20th century. But many African religions celebrate sacred place and sacred nature. And if you were stolen from Africa and moved to the New World, actually one of the only things you might have, you might not have your mama or your daddy, your language, if everybody around you spoke a different language, you literally might not have any of your clothes, your historical foodstuffs, but you would still have the sun in the sky. You would still have the stars. One of the things you would still have is the natural nature world. But through lynching, through exploitation of Black people as a attribute of the land, not as honored by the land, when Black people were worked like animals on the land and treated like crops, our love of nature, our love of the sun and the stars, the ocean that helped kidnap us, gets broken. We fall out of love, no fault of our own, from nature because we are abused in nature. We are used in nature. But there is this impetus, this old tradition, this African sense of sacred place, sacred nature, that sometimes, somehow gets revived over and over again. And you find it in country songs. You find it in Al Green's album, Belle. You find it in Recy Palmer's song, Somerville. You find it in my song, Who's Minding the Garden? We're remembering this is Eden. And there was an Eden before the fall. And there was a Black relationship with nature that predated the slave trade and can be revived anew in this 21st century.
As I'm listening to you, I'm reminded of conversations I had on this show with Leah Penniman, who talked about Black Americans reclaiming their relationship to nature, even though some parts of that history have been torturous in terms of that connection to nature, and how it can be beautiful and liberating, but having to work through the intentional ways that people have been disconnected. I have a very dear friend who is a professor at Prairie View A&M University in Texas. And she reminds me that Prairie View, as an historically Black college on the site of what was a former plantation, has one of the oldest Black trail riding societies in this country. And how people are keeping that history alive, but telling it because of their connection to the sacred, even when others deny that. And it reminds me of where we are right now, Alice, of Beyoncé releasing this new album, Cowboy Carter, and all of the think pieces of people saying, does she have the right to make a country album? You know, what does she know about that? And it's frankly so discouraging and angering to know that here's a woman whose roots on both sides of her family are solidly in that space, in that connection as well. What do you think it means that Beyoncé is exploring this genre that isn't a new appearance, but has people forgetting all of the things that you've just said about that history and the connection that predates the person, but creates opportunity?
I think there's some shocking ignorance and amnesia in this world. And I can't repeat this often enough, and particularly for your listeners who may not know this. The roots of Black country go deep and go as far as the roots of country. Even if we look at commercially recorded country, the first star of the Grand Ole Opry, the first superstar of the Grand Ole Opry, is Dee Ford Bailey, a Black man from Tennessee, who was a third generation, what he called Black hillbilly musician. So Dee Ford Bailey will perform on WSM Barn Dance in 1927, right after the phrase Grand Ole Opry was used for the first time. The next thing you hear is Dee Ford Bailey playing his harmonica. As said, he will be a star on the Opry and help launch other careers of other artists on the Opry. But in 1930, we're going to get Blue Yodel No. 9, which many people to this day consider to be the most iconic country song of all time. And who's playing on that, aside from Jimmy Rogers, who everyone knows? Lil Hardin Armstrong, Black woman born in Memphis, Tennessee, attends Fisk for 3 years. She plays on every bar a Blue Yodel number 9. She's the piano player on it. She's driving the session. I think she likely brought the song to the session, but she gets erased from the history of the song. But she doesn't get erased from knowledge of this in the Black world, because the year I was born, 59, Ray Charles had a hit with number one song in the on R&B charts, I believe, called Just for a Thrill. That's a Lil Hardin song. A couple years later, now here's Lil, who played on that big country hit, million seller in 1930. Ray Charles is going to put out his own modern sounds in country and Western music. This is an album that will deconstruct and reconstruct country music. So what I say is Dee Ford is the father, Lil is the mama, and Ray Charles is the genius child of Black country. And then I think Dee Ford's side child is Country is Cornbread, Charlie Pride, who will be the second Black man to be on the Opry after Dee Ford. And Lil stepchild will be Herb Jeffries, who is the bronze buckaroo, the Black singing cowboy. But from those five people that I've just given you, these are the roots and that Beyoncé is perhaps the most vivid and exquisite ever flower of. She is metaphorically Ray Charles's genius child, who eclipses the father. But she draws with all the cowboy imagery from the tradition established by the Bronze Buckaroo. She has said that this album is influenced by movies. You know, the Bronze Buckaroo, Herb Jeffrey too, was influenced by movies. So I love that she is working in a long established tradition. I put Dee Ford back there in 1927 on the radio. That's over 100 years ago. But if you want to go back before that, the Black cowboys in the 19th century who are riding the ranges in New Mexico, all through the Southwest and up to the Northwest, actually, these people in cowboy camps, Black and brown cowboys, had a singing and a song tradition. And we find many of these songs collected as early as 1906, 1907. And Thorpe is one of the people who first collected these songs, and people have forgotten that the first cowboy camp he ever encountered, he says, was a Black cowboy camp. So the Black cowboy song tradition is even older. That's in the 19th century. And Scott Joplin, who most people will know, his mama was also a fiddler, and he came up actually in a family band that we would recognize as a kind of hillbilly band. And this, again, is early days.
I appreciate you for laying out that lineage, because that history and that context is so critical. Because what I fear that it does, Alice, when we don't address it, is that it erases all of that talent. It erases all of the struggle that people had to go through to be present. And it feels even more damaging when the people who should care about presence and the preservation of that are complicit in the erasure. One of the things that will not be allowed to happen is any erasure of the imprint of Alice Randall. In addition to this new memoir, which is so important to that understanding, there's a new album too called, you're having a great year, My Black Country, The Songs of Alice Randall. It records songs, includes songs that are recorded by Black women like Rhiannon Giddens, and also your daughter. What's it like to hear those songs through this new lens?
It is an absolute and complete Juneteenth experience. It is good news at long last. It is the best news at long last. I feel that these extraordinary women rode to the rescue of my legacy. Nothing less than that. They rode to the rescue of my legacy. That when I have been erased from my own songs, when my voice had been muted, they have loaned to me their stunning voices.
There is such a look of joy that has crept across your face, a joy, a respect, a reverence, and an excitement. And when I think about where we are in these times, it's what we all need more of, more joy, more excitement, and more belief in the possibility. My last question to you is this: what do you say to young artists who are trying to find their way and are navigating some of the same challenges, but also able to enjoy the smoother paths because of what you and others have done. What's your message to young artists?
The one thing is, don't let anyone turn you around. You know, I quote that Fairfield 4 song, gospel song early on, don't let anyone turn you around. Be your own North Star and your own best critic. Defer to your own assessment analysis of your own work. Also, tell the story only you can tell that the world needs. Writing is a kind of therapy, but public writing isn't that. You can write for your own therapy and put it aside in a drawer. When you're writing for the world, you need to offer necessary stories, stories that the world needs, stories that actually contribute to the world. It's not a narcissistic, self-serving gesture at that point. It's really important to think about what you know that the world needs. And when you do that, you will find your audience. But it's the you part is, you know what the world needs that you can only create. And so that's what I say. And I say, enjoy, find your joy, that joy is radical. And creation and connection are the antithesis of destruction and evil. They are the antithesis of it. And we need as many people creating and creating that which nurtures ourselves and as many people as possible, as quick as possible, as often as possible. That's so real.
Well, here's to more creation and connection. And we thank you and honor you, Alice Randall, for all that you are creating and connecting us to. Alice Randall is a best-selling novelist, chart-topping songwriter, and professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. Her newest book is a memoir. It's titled My Black Country, a journey through country music's Black past, present, and future. Alice Randall, thank you so much.
Thank you. And let me say, great critics propel great art. And I am thrilled to be on with you with your insight, because you water our creations. Great critics propel great art. Thank you for being one of the greats.
Disrupted is produced by Kevin Chang Barnum, Wayne Edwards, Meg Dalton, and Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Scout Raimondo and Sajina Shrestha. You can listen to all the previous episodes of Disrupted by finding us wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kalila Brown-Dean, leaving you with Valerie June playing the song Big Dream. It was written by Alice Randall. Thanks for listening.